If there are no further questions, we'll proceed to the second paper, which will be given by David Huber. The title is J.H. Van Vleck and Magnetism at the University of Wisconsin, 1928 to 34.
Thank you. Need a little help here. This is a slide you've seen before. I did put it in to emphasize that we're talking about Van Vleck's activities at the University of Wisconsin when he was a professor, assistant or associate, and full professor, interval 1928 to 2034. And then I will have something to say at the end of my talk about later activities relating back to that period. And I'll also, we've seen this before a couple of times, but I did want to point out something in the background. First of all, if you look closely at this, you'll see some LS coupling calculations of the splitting between different J levels and some atomic equation here. So this is when Van Vleck was probably teaching quantum mechanics and maybe specializing in applications of quantum mechanics to atomic structure. And this was maybe late in the spring or early in the fall. I don't think he taught in the summer, but the fans are what was air conditioning in those days. Those of you who given colloquy at the University of Wisconsin 5 or more years ago probably used the blackboards that we have here. We were in this particular lecture hall until about 2005, and then we gave that up to the campus in general and moved over into new modern lecture halls with electrically controlled blackboard, or whiteboards we call them now, and we're up to date. But we had something like this for many years, well after into the latter part of the 20th century. Now, I want to begin by talking about, there's one more picture here that comes from the collection that was given to us by Dr. Comstock. And as I mentioned earlier, the Solvay Conference in 1930, and Van Vleck is in attendance there. And next to him is Enrico Fermi, and I think Pauli and Heisenberg and Dirac are in the back row here. And of course, the grand old man is right there. We'll come back to this, in fact, we've heard about it, but this influential trip to Europe in 1930. It was very important for the development of susceptibilities. This is my talk. I want to consider two things. Susceptibilities, which we've heard a little bit about, and we'll hear more about in terms of going through some of the contributions that Van made and the changes that he brought to the field. And then I want to talk about some new material, new in the sense that it hasn't been published before, but what was in notes for a second edition of his book on electric and magnetic susceptibilities, and we'll get to that. It has to do with local fields. In this context, it's local fields in dielectric media, but there are obvious applications to magnetic media. So let me start with his work in 1928 and 29. This is after he came to Wisconsin, but the first paper, which Michelle mentioned, at least alluded to, that had to do with susceptibility in condensed matter, was published in 1928, but it was written when he was at Minnesota and submitted, I think, in February of 1928, before he made the move over the summer to Madison. And this, he developed a thoroughly modern approach to calculation of magnetic susceptibilities involving the new quantum mechanics. And then he followed this up at Wisconsin with applications of the theory to the magnetic susceptibilities of rare earth ions and also ions in the iron group. And this is a collaboration with his student Amelia Frank, whom Chun tells me later on married Eugene Wigner, but that's an aside. Okay, paramagnetic susceptibilities. Paramagnetism means that at low fields that the magnetization is proportional to the applied field, and this coefficient is positive, greater than zero, and that's why we refer to it as paramagnetic susceptibilities. And the calculation that Frank and Van Vleck worked out started with a picture of a free ion, an LS or Russell-Saunders coupling, with a Zeeman interaction of the standard form. The GJ there is the Lande G factor. And the susceptibility of circa theory 1927-26 has this form here. And here's the celebrated one-third factor, the Lande and Bohr magnetons, and then the J plus 1 over KT. And the important point is that this is a temperature-dependent susceptibility, and we will come back and see how well that agrees with experiment and to understand why in some celebrated cases it doesn't. So let me talk about Van Vleck's contribution to susceptibility in this 1928 paper and the 1929 analysis. He introduced the idea of temperature-independent paramagnetism. Remember that the old theory, albeit quantum mechanical, the susceptibility was inversely proportional to the temperature. But Van Vleck pointed out that there's another term which gives rise to a susceptibility that is temperature independent. This is not the same as the temperature independence of the susceptibility of the electron gas. The origin is different, but the absence of a temperature dependence is shared with the Pauli spin susceptibility. And the connection is that when you're talking about real atoms, real materials, you have to take into account the possibility of a coupling between the ground state, which is here, and this thing, well, I'll put this as that, the ground state and the excited state through the Zeeman interaction. And the Zeeman interaction in LS coupling, as most of you know, has this form here. It's well defined in terms of the total orbital angular momentum and the total spin. And the delta over there just simply denotes the energy splitting between the ground state and the excited state. Now, this is one way of looking at it. It's not exactly the approach that he outlined, but the results are in the picture are identical. And one way of thinking about this phenomenon is that the Zeeman interaction admixes excited state wave functions into the ground state and the ground state into the excited state. And if you do this and just follow through and restrict yourself to the usual case where the effect is important, that is KT much less than the splitting, only the ground state is occupied. And what you end up with is a temperature-independent contribution to the susceptibility that involves matrix elements of the momentum part of the Zeeman interaction between the ground and excited states, that square of that divided by the energy splitting, and then some usual Bohr magnetons and particles per unit volume. Okay. What Van Vleck and Frank did was to take that calculation and apply it to rare earth, and that's what I want to talk about here, and also iron group salts. And this is the first half of the light half of the rare earth series. And what you have up here are, in the top row, are trivalents ranging from lanthanum, promethium, samarium and europium, and then gadolinium. And down here, the one row below, you have the standard way of labeling the states, 2s plus 1, the spin, the orbital angular momentum, and then the angular momentum of the total angular momentum of the ground state or ground manifold. And But you come up here, and let's look at europium, which is a celebrated example. This is J equal to zero. And the third row is the old theory. That's the temperature-dependent only susceptibility. And you see that as you follow this along, and the results are reasonable until you come to here, samarium, and even more so, europium. Europium, you remember, is a J equals zero, and that formula had J times J plus one, so there is no temperature dependent susceptibility, and that's reflected in the zero that appears in that column. The Van Vleck-Frank calculation, which takes into account the excited states and the spin orbit coupling, comes up with a finite value and compares with quite well with the available experiments, which were, I believe, published in 1925. Samarium, there is a finite value because the spin 5/2, but it's not nearly as large as what is found experimentally. And again, the Van Vleck-Frank calculation is a significant improvement. Not as much improvement here, going from 0 to 3.6, but still is significant, more than a factor of 2. And what this is, to my knowledge, is really the first confirmation of this presence of this temperature-dependent, independent susceptibility. And it was a significant and really stellar achievement at that time. These are just some technical points here. They didn't measure over a wide temperature range, so they took an apparent Bohr magneton number, which was related to the experimental susceptibility in dividing things out, and this compared this with the experimental values. Now, the calculations we talked about here were really free ion. There wasn't any mention of anything else. It was applied to magnetic salts and ions in solution equally well, and represented a very good approximation for the first half of the rare earth series, and also very good for the second half of the heavy rare earths. However, there, because of the inversion of the levels, J equal L plus S for the ground state, the contribution of the temperature-dependent term is significantly larger, and the difference between what we call the old theory and the Van Vleck-Frank theory was not very large. Now let me go on to something that was left out of this analysis, and that's crystal field effects, or might call it crystalline Stark effect sometimes, and it's the effect of the surrounding ions on the magnetic ion. And simple picture has this something like a electrostatic field. It's in reality, it's more complicated in some materials involving covalency and so forth. But we can talk about it as a crystal field effect here. And there was a problem because until Beta came along and showed how to analyze the level, energy levels of ions in the the crystalline electric field of different symmetries, there wasn't a real, and we didn't have the computing that we have now, a real problem in how to include the crystal field effects in the calculation susceptibility. It turns out that in the iron group, these were really very significant. And Beta showed this, and then my understanding is from some of the biographical material that Van Vleck found out about Beta's calculation from one of the Dutch physicists when he went to Europe in 1930. So this is still before he finished his book. So this is in the book. he talks about Beta's work. And then we jump ahead from 1930 or 1929 to 1932. And there were three papers that appeared. And talking about the influence of crystalline fields on susceptibilities in the paramagnetic ions and also the iron group ions. The first and third were by Van Vleck's postdocs, Bill Penny and Robert Schlapp, And notice that Van doesn't have his name on it. I think he's very proud of what these people did, and he wanted them to get full credit for their contributions. And then he had a paper here in between the two. It follows in the same issue of the Physical Review. It follows right after the Penny Schlapp paper. And I want to say a few words about this paper. I've been told that this is one here is one of Van's favorite papers, because he was able to obtain significant results without having to do extensive calculations. I guess it's the postdocs, as usual, handled the extensive calculations, but then the master came in and showed that you could learn a lot just from symmetry. Okay, and the main focus, or one of the main foci of this paper that he wrote, was the variation between the susceptibilities of divalent nickel and the divalent cobalt. And here he lists three characteristics that he has to incorporate. And one is that nickel is essentially an isotropic susceptibility with approximately a spin-only Curie constant. That is, the orbital angular momentum seems to be making no contribution to the susceptibility. Cobalt has a significant anisotropy in the susceptibility and a Curie constant that differs significantly from spin only. And then here is that the two ions are adjacent in the periodic table and in orbital S states. So they have the same orbital angular momentum properties, approximately, and one has isotropic susceptibility and spin only, no evidence of orbital angular momentum, and cobalt has significant anisotropy. And Van Vleck's explanation, this is all due to crystal field effects, and there were two components to this. One had to do with the fact that you have a reversal of the crystal field levels in going from nickel to cobalt. And this can be thought of somewhat loosely as a particle hole symmetry. You have in one case, you have the D8. You can think of this as two holes. And the D7 for cobalt, you can think of this as two electrons. And this is the crystal field splitting. These are taken from the article. Crystal field levels with beta's notation here. This is a singlet and then two triplets. And then cobalt, the situation is reversed, namely, I mean, there's maybe some overall scaling, but you have the triplets lowest and the singlet highest. What I did was just reverse the pictures. And the second part of this was the quenching of the ground state orbital magnetic moment in nickel. And this quenching of the orbital angular momentum, I understand it was a Van Vleck contribution that he pointed out. And it's this result here that explains why nickel has a nearly spin-only isotropic susceptibility. Namely, the orbital effects in the lowest crystal field level are quenched. And so it's to a very high degree of approximation. So you have a susceptibility that comes from the spin moments, and that's that. In cobalt, with the reverse levels, you have a threefold degenerate level, which is split in the magnetic field, again in the cubic symmetry. Lower symmetry will produce other splittings, but in the cubic symmetry, this threefold manifold is lowest, it's anisotropic, and then the one above is also threefold degenerate, and the singlet then appears at the top. And so it's the these are orbital wave functions, and there's a strong orbital content to the ground state and a strong, therefore, an orbital component to the magnetic response. So all of this comes from these two ideas, one which has to do with the reversal of the crystal field levels and going from nickel to cobalt, and the second, the quenching of the ground state, an orbital singlet. Now, I want to turn now to the theory of electric and magnetic susceptibilities. You've heard about this before. Oxford University Press, 1932. The manuscript was completed in 1931. So this was work before the papers of Penny and Schlapp were published. They are not referred to in the book, to my knowledge. And what I want to go over is some very interesting notes that were passed on to Chun by Van's widow, Abigail. And they're notes for a second edition. And it's an incomplete set of notes in the sense that he only has changes for the first six chapters and nothing in the magnetism that follows. He didn't get to that. But I think there are many interesting things in the first chapters. But the one I want to focus on now are the local field and dielectric constants of condensed media. This is a new chapter. Others are changes, minor changes. Quantum mechanical foundations is rewritten extensively, but it's basically a pedagogical change chapter. This one is the new material. I want to take a bit of time off and comment on that. And these are the sections for the local field chapter. And as they point out, he points out there are demagnetizing corrections and local field corrections in magnetism. And there are, at the time, he worked on the problem, and this work was the Lorentz field was in the 19th century. Ansager had a different way of looking at it in the papers published in 1937. And Van Vleck weighed in. There was a controversy, and I guess which lasted longer than about 10 or 15 years longer. Is the Lorentz field the right way to look at it, or the Ansager local field? That occupied physical chemists and people who measure dielectric constants in liquids and mixtures and so forth. And Van Vleck weighed in 1937 with a microscopic calculation of some of these effects to some degree of approximation. And let me just begin this just to remind you that the local field is it's not the average over the sample, it's the average field to which a molecule in the material is subjected to when you have a macroscopic E field is applied. This is taken from the book. And here are the two theories and really encapsulated. Ansager, 1936, and the local field is, for polar molecules, is the same as the Lorentz local field. But for polarizable molecules, The local field for polarizable molecules is the same in the Lorentz theory and the Ansager theory, that's here. But for polar molecules, that is molecules which have a permanent electric dipole moment, or in the case of magnetic materials, a permanent magnetic dipole moment, and in that case they could be spins, you have a significant difference between the local fields. And the question is, how does this show up in things that you can measure directly in those days? And this is just a cartoon that is taken, or a drawing that is taken from his 1937 paper. And that shows the polarization that's in the Lorentz model is unaffected by the cavity. And then in the Ansager model, you put a sort of fictitious dipole there, produce a modification of the polarization in the surrounding material outside the cavity. And the question, as I said there, which is the better approximation? This is what Van Vleck addressed. And here's his footnote that comes in the chapter, and I'll let you read it, but basically what he's saying is that he was, as far as he knows, the first attempt to carry out a calculation, microscopic calculation, working directly with the partition function. So he's had the partition function written, and which contained the classical dipole-dipole interaction. And I think this was last sentence there accounts for the motivation, in this chapter. Namely, he thinks he did do a better job in the notes for the new edition. And basically, this is how he did it. He took the dipolar action interaction and expanded the partition function and calculated the dielectric constant, and then used the Clausius-Mossadi equation, which is shown in the lower line there, to make a comparison between the Lorentz-Debye and Ansager theories. And the Clausius-Mossadi equation, where you have the polarizability over there, the alpha term, is the same for both theories, but it's the question mark that follows that distinguishes the Lorentz model from the Ansager model and from also Van Vleck's microscopic calculations. And this is the conclusion, and said according, the results are, and he made a comparison with experiment, or he cited results from an extensive comparison experiment made by two scientists at the National Bureau of Standards. And so the calculation are, thus, it has put it nicely, just about halfway between those of Ansager and Lorentz-Debye, which is qualitatively consistent with the experimental results. So that brought that chapter to an end. I want to go back and point out something here which I didn't. This is one of the most interesting things here. This is a section of the chapter on the inadequacy of the local field constant. This comes in after, and I know it's added probably in the end of the 1960s or early 1970s, and it refers to some experiments carried out, nuclear quadrupole resonance in liquids. Nuclear quadrupole resonance measures the electric field distribution, and what was found there, that instead of having a single value for the local field, you had a distribution of local field. So it kind of took some of the excitement out of the distinction, worrying about the distinction between Ansager and Lorentz. It's just not consistent with experiment either way. Okay. And we go back. Here we go. I should mention that an edited chapter 4 is available as a PDF from the Physics Department website, and I think it's up now or will be in the next day or two. And we would welcome comments, questions, and so forth relating to that. And finally, Van Vleck biographical memoirs were helpful to me. Phil Anderson, the National Academy of Sciences in 1987, and Brevis Blini, the Fellows of the Royal Society in 1982. So I guess with that, I'll end and entertain questions.
We want to thank Dave Huber for editing and also for deciphering Van's handwriting. Those of us who have read his handwriting, we knew that it was a challenging job, and Dave did a beautiful work on this. And Dave, I want to ask you, when in the previous, it was referred to the part 3 of the absorption rate. It was referred to that the third part 3 of the paper. When did he get the idea of continuing on the part 3 of the paper?
I don't know. I mean, it was done at Minnesota, and I think that the title of the paper and what came in parts 1 and part 2 were not directly applicable to the magnetic susceptibilities of real materials. And part 3 gave equation which contained the old theory with the 1 over KT and the temperature-independent term. That's, as far as I know, the first time that appeared in the literature, but then it was cited by Van Vleck and Frank in their paper.
Are there any other questions?